Chapter 14. Gust's Secret. In retirement in Rome in 1992, just after the collapse of the Soviets' puppet government in Kabul, Gustav Rakatos strolled across town to the Spanish Steps to buy the daily newspapers. Life was good but tame these days. It was the curse of all operations officers to be put out to pasture at 50, after almost 30 intense years of scheming on behalf of their country. Avrakatos was working on several money-making ventures, but nothing had come through yet, and there really wasn't much to do but see the sights and remember. A column in that day's Wall Street Journal immediately caught his eye. Entitled "The Afghan Who Won the Cold War," it was about an old friend of sorts, the legendary Afghan commander Ahmad Shah Massoud, and the writer claimed that, as much as Lech Walesa, Pope John Paul II, and Ronald Reagan, Mr. Massoud broke the back of Soviet imperialism. Avrakatos knew something about the columnist Robert Kaplan. He was one of the more gifted writers on Afghanistan. A few months before, he had somehow gotten Gust's name and number and tried to get him to talk. But Avrakatos hates the press and hadn't even made an effort to be nice when he said no. Now, as he read Kaplan's article, he found himself enthusiastically agreeing with the writer's assertion that the Afghan war had played a decisive role in bringing on the collapse of the entire communist empire. Not enough people understood just how devastating the CIA war had been to the Soviets, but the author was not praising the agency. In fact, he seemed to believe that most of the credit for defeating the Red Army was due to this one guerrilla leader, so great that he belonged in the historical company of Tito, Ho Chi Minh, Mao Zedong, and Che Guevara. After conferring this recognition, Kaplan ended with a swipe at the CIA for having failed to recognize and adequately support this one true independent Afghan commander. Avrakatos smiled. He always smiled when he read these attacks. It was like receiving a medal. All the reporters had taken up this line about the CIA giving short shrift to the Lion of the Panjshir. Now that the war was over, they were all complaining about how the agency had backed the wrong horses, giving the weapons and support to Khomeini-style Muslims instead of the noble Massoud. What prompted Avrakatos to smile so broadly that day was his little secret. Massoud hadn't just come out of nowhere. It was he, Gust Laskaris Avrakatos of Aliquippa, and the Central Intelligence Agency, who had made it possible for Ahmad Shah Massoud to realize his greatness. And what made it all such a perfect spy's delight was that nobody knew. The story of Avrakatos's machinations on behalf of the great commander begins with his trip to London with John McGaffin in 1983 to meet the cousins at MI6. It had been a generous invitation, and Avrakatos had been grateful when McGaffin invited him to come along to meet their British counterparts. Though Gust was expected to be acting chief for only a few months, McGaffin introduced him as his replacement, which immediately conferred status upon him and gave him a license to operate independently with the British service. MI6 members always did their best to be good hosts when their agency friends came over on these official visits. McGaffin and Cogan loved the routine, the dinners at the venerable men's clubs, the personal introductions to the best tailors on Savile Row, and the gushing but understated reception from the staff of the Basil Street Hotel, MI6's choice for its favored guests. The hotel reeked of old-world charm. But none of this worked for Avrakatos. It made him feel claustrophobic. He didn't like the quaint wooden toilet seats in the hotel's tiny bathrooms. McGaffin good-naturedly asked him, "Well, what do you shit on in Aliquippa, Gust?" What Avrakatos says he found particularly distasteful about the British spies were the fucking teas. Can you believe it? They interrupted meetings every day at 3:30 or 4 for tea and cookies. Gust's escort officer was only trying to make this unpolished American feel at home. "Now that you'll be coming here frequently," the distinguished Englishman in the dark suit offered, "perhaps we could suggest a few things you'd like to shop for." He mentioned a visit to his tailor, or perhaps his shoemaker. "I was patient with him until he exhausted my patience," Gust says. "Look, fuckhead, I didn't come here to buy shoes," he had growled. Part of the reason for his explosion was a certain sensitivity to his class. Long ago, Avrakatos had realized that he could never look like an Ivy Leaguer, much less a British aristocrat, so he had taken to defiantly dressing in marked contrast. Since he had decided not to play the clothes game at Langley, He wasn't about to get seduced into trying to look like one of Smiley's people in London.
"Look, if you're trying to make me look like a Brit, and it takes going to your tailor to get into your club for dinner, it's not going to happen," he snapped. "Besides that, I prefer pub grub."
At this point, the unflappable Englishman won Avrakatos over. Without missing a beat, he looked at me and said, "Pub grub, yes. Well, pub grub it shall be." Later, McGaffin told Gust how unfortunate it was that he couldn't have experienced the club. Avrakatos didn't have the heart to explain. The MI6 spies were impressive as they moved about their old imperial capital, but Avrakatos's eye is keenly trained to spot what's known in the trade as recruitable weaknesses. Like everyone else, he had heard about MI6's financial problems, but at their headquarters he was nevertheless struck by the extreme shabbiness of their operation. Before long, he realized that this once proud service, in whose image the CIA had been formed, was virtually bankrupt. It was Avrakatos's cunning that allowed him to sense, in this financial despair, a unique opportunity to bypass the agency's lawyers and play tough through a surrogate. What initially caught the CIA man's interest in the British was how knowledgeable they were about the war. It made sense. They'd been operating in Afghanistan and Pakistan since the 19th century, and some of their agents were sons or grandsons of operatives who had worked for the British Raj. "They have guys who have lived there for 20 years as journalists or authors or tobacco growers," explains Avrakatos. When the Soviets invaded, MI6 activated these old networks. In spite of their lack of resources, both the British government and MI6 wanted to continue to play a role on the world stage. From their days of empire, Afghanistan was a very familiar arena. They knew the players and the terrain, and figured they could make a mark even with very little money by focusing their efforts on Massoud, the Afghan leader who controlled the one critical area of the country. It was because of MI6's intimate connections to Massoud that Avrakatos had come to London. The commander had stopped fighting, and the CIA wanted to know why. By the agency's reckoning, there were about 300 reasonably serious commanders in action against the Soviets at that time, but the critical factor of terrain made Massoud indispensable. His Panjshir Valley lies close to the Afghan capital and airfields where most of the Soviets' 40th Army was based. Even more significant, the Soviets depended on the narrow Salang Pass and highway that snaked through Massoud's mountains from their border. With over 100,000 troops totally dependent on everything from spare parts and ammunition to medicine, vodka, and Russian food, the supplies moving down the Salang had become the lifeblood of the 40th Army. It simply couldn't survive without keeping this line open. "Geographically, it was the key," says Avrakatos. Throughout the early years of the war, the Red Army repeatedly invaded the Panjshir in division strength. These engagements were like scenes out of Apocalypse Now, with artillery barrages, helicopter assaults, and carpet bombing, followed by great sweeps with overwhelming numbers of men. Each time, the Lion of the Panjshir had followed the age-old guerrilla tactic, ordering his people to fall back to the mountains and passes beyond, to bide their time sniping and ambushing until the Russians moved out. As Avrakatos saw it, the Soviets were being sucker-punched almost every time they tried to march into Massoud's narrow valley. "It was like every cowboy movie where the wagon train comes in and then the Indians attack on either side." The French doctors from Médecins Sans Frontières, who had gone into the Panjshir early in the war, had come out with film and stories that promoted Massoud as the ultimate freedom fighter. Ken Follett would later make him the demigod of his bestseller, Lie Down with Lions. He was the only Afghan to capture the imagination of the world beyond the Hindu Kush. But in 1983, when Massoud stopped fighting, agency intelligence came to the disturbing conclusion that he had cut a deal with the Soviets. What made this particularly worrisome was that it was not the first time. In 1981, and again in 1982, the Afghan commander had also stopped fighting, in exchange for Soviet offers of food and guarantees that the Red Army would leave his villages alone. Avrakatos, ever the prepared student, had read everything he could find in the agency's files about Massoud and the tribes who made up the CIA's army of freedom fighters. What he learned made him think that perhaps Massoud was not being handled correctly. The CIA had deeded to the Pakistan Intelligence Service, the ISI, the right to decide which Mujahideen leaders would receive the agency's weapons, and, without question, Massoud was being shortchanged. the overwhelming bulk of CIA weaponry was being funneled to the renowned Pashtun tribesmen who had long dominated Afghan politics. No one could question the ISI's backing of the Pashtuns, fierce warriors renowned for having repeatedly humiliated the British in the 19th century. They were fighting heroically against the Soviets, dying in staggering numbers, and refusing to give up. Zia's intelligence chief, General Akhtar, himself part Pashtun, harbored the deepest suspicions about Massoud. He resented the gushing publicity about this Afghan who wouldn't fight. He knew that MI6 agents masquerading as journalists were part of the Massoud propaganda machine. As for the French, he told Howard Hart that the only reason they were enraptured was that the so-called Lion of Panjshir was poking the French nurses. It was all Hart could do, drawing on his close relationship with Akhtar, to convince the ISI chief not to reduce the meager supplies set aside for Massoud. Hart himself, however, was deeply suspicious, even angered by Massoud's refusal to move on the Salang Highway. He passed on his doubts to Langley, along with the ISI's crude joke about the unmanly nature of Massoud's Tajiks. When a Pashtun wants to make love to a woman, his first choice is always a Tajik man.